So let's begin with the motivation. And this week we've been fortunate to study with Geshe Shitabke about emptiness and develop that side of the path, looking at the ultimate nature. But for our understanding of emptiness to be truly effective, we need to combine it with concentration and have a unity of serenity and insight focused on emptiness of inherent existence. So for that reason, it's also important to generate concentration or serenity. And this serenity is also necessary to really integrate bodhicitta with our mind, and really permeate our mind with bodhicitta understanding. And so with this in mind, with the aim of attaining full awakening, so where you are most capable to offer service to all living beings, then let's learn about how to develop serenity. Yeah, we'll continue where we left off. So there's somebody named Bodhi Bhadra. If somebody could look up Bodhi Bhadra quickly and see who he is. Bodhi Bhadra. Okay, so he explained that there's a variety of meditation objects that can be used to attain serenity. We've gone through some of them in the last session. We talked about the extensive objects, the objects to purify behavior, the objects of expertise, and the objects for purifying afflictions. And so he has another way of putting them, of categorizing these and adding some more too. Okay, so he talks about serenity attained by looking inwards and serenity based on an object of meditation. So under his heading of serenity attained by looking inwards, he has focusing on the body and focusing what is based on the body. And then under focusing on the body, yeah, he has focusing on the body itself in the aspect of a deity. So it's quite interesting because here he's talking about attaining, it mostly looks like it's tantra, a tantric perspective, yeah. So focusing on the body itself in the aspect of the deity, focusing on the body as foul, as a skeleton, that's a sutra view, okay, and focusing on a special syllable or implement of a deity. So those are different meditation objects that you can use. Two of them are used in tantra, one in sutra. It's interesting to think, for those of you who practice tantra, that you that in sutra we have focusing on mindfulness of the body as the body being what it is, you know, the 32 or 36 elements of the body and finding it as something that's quite foul and unattractive. And then you have the tantric mindfulness of the body, which is you do after dissolving into emptiness and then reappearing as the deity and then developing mindfulness or serenity on the deity body. So it's interesting to think, two similar meditations, mindfulness on the body, but two different kinds of bodies that you're mindful of. And then under his outline of focusing on what is based on the body, there's focusing on the breath, yeah, which is sutra perspective, focusing on a subtle divine syllable, it's tantra, focusing on the drops, which is tantra, and focusing on the aspects of light rays. I'm not sure what that one is. And then focusing on rapture and bliss, which are actually two feelings when you in the dhyana stages. And then under his outline of serenity based on an object of meditation, there's a special object where he has, again, focusing on a deity's body and focusing on a deity's speech, which would be the sound of the mantra. And an uncommon, but it doesn't say what the uncommon one is. But it's interesting, I'm going through this because it's interesting to see how different meditation masters talk about the objects of meditation. I'm wondering, I wasn't planning on talking about the Pali tradition view of the objects of meditation. Is that something that you would be interested in hearing about? And if so, would you want to hear about it as we're talking about objects of meditation, or would you want to hear about it on a special unit about the Pali version of how to do it? Yeah, maybe I'll just go through the kasinas next week or something to do that and stick with our tradition now. Okay, so then there's some other objects that we could develop serenity on. One, of course, is the breath. You know, that one that is also very popular in the Pali tradition. And it's not just watching the inhalations and exhalations. Actually, the Satipatthana Sutra corresponds with the four establishments of mindfulness. You know, it has 16 phases in the breathing meditation in the Pali tradition, and those correspond with different phases in the four mindfulnesses. Yeah, so quite interesting that, you know, I mean, it's really emphasizing the four establishments of mindfulness. Okay, anyway, the breath is not as subtle an object as, let's say, meditating on the conventional nature of the mind, which we'll get into, and it's not as gross as an external object, something like that. But it can be effective for attaining serenity. And some people find that when they focus on the breath for long periods of time, the mind becomes very still and very settled. And that's quite a relief from the intensity of the afflictions when they bombard our mind. And so developing that kind of concentration on the breath, you know, if you, when you're doing it, when you're meditating, your mind is calm. But also, if you learn during the day to bring your mind back to the breath and use that as a technique to calm your mind down if afflictions start arising. But His Holiness says that even though that's a good way to subdue the afflictions, it's for a more lasting and powerful approach to subduing afflictions is to reflect on dependent arising, emptiness, and the benefits of bodhicitta. Okay, Of course, in the Pali tradition, you know, if you're doing the breathing meditation in conjunction with the four establishments of mindfulness, then you can develop, use it for the development of insight and realization of selflessness there. Okay, then some other objects that we can use. One is the conventional nature of the mind. Okay, and so this is the observed object. So this is not the emptiness of the mind. That's the ultimate nature of the mind. This is just the clear and cognizant nature of the mind. Okay, and so we're focusing just on that clarity, which is sometimes translated as luminosity, but I don't know why it is translated as luminosity. You know, I mean, the word in Tibetan is sel, which usually just means clear. And to me, luminosity means it's radiant, which to me is very different than something being clear.
I was wondering if it's because there is a quote in Sutra where the Buddha says, "Oh, bhikkhus, the mind is luminous."
But that could probably be translated as the mind is clear.
Oh, I see.
You see? It's often just, they translate the same word, at least in the Tibetan, as either clear or some translate it as luminous.
And thinking about a comparison between those two words, I kind of think about looking out during the daylight.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear when it's luminous. You can't see far when it's dark.
Yeah.
So in that sense is how I kind of compare the two words. Like it's when I look out during the daylight, when it's luminous, it's clear.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Okay. So when sometimes we hear the phrase, the mind focuses on mind. And so don't think here of the mind looking at itself. Rather, it's one moment of mind looking at the previous moment of mind. Okay, because the mind can't see itself the exact moment of mind. It has to look at the previous moment as an object. Okay, and so this, occurs in, of course, you're looking at the mind just, you know, a nanosecond behind, not like 5 years behind. But to do this, you have to be able to recognize the conventional nature of the mind, which is not so easy. Yeah, because if you don't recognize it correctly, it's easy to get into blank mind and constant, just meditating on nothingness or something like that. So the mind is like a crystal in the sense that when you put a crystal on a cloth, then you have the color of the cloth becomes very prominent, but you can't see the clarity of the crystal. You have to remove the crystal from the cloth or from any other thing behind it to actually see the clarity of the crystal itself. So in the same way, it's the same with our mind. When we're having sense consciousness is focused on an external object, or when our mental consciousness is thinking about something, planning something, visualizing something, whatever, then the mind is, you know, engrossed in an object, and that object takes prominence like the color of the cloth when the crystal is on it. And so to actually see the conventional nature of the mind, we have to remove the mind from all of these external and internal objects. Yeah. And so when we're meditating, that's one reason for lowering our eyes. We're not really looking at anything. So we're trying to cut out the external objects. Of course, we can't always cut out sound. So you just have to learn how to focus, and then you don't get so distracted by sound. So we have to try and focus the mind inwards, but of course then we start having planning the future and remembering the past, don't we? Yeah, so we have some there people here. How many of you tend to dwell more on the future planning? And how many of you dwell more on the past and what happened to you? Yeah? And you go back and forth? Yes. So we can see, you know, we very easily get stuck in the past. We get stuck in the future. And so those objects, you know, come to mind a lot. We're quite distracted by them. And that's also involved with making the mind having a lot of hopes and a lot of fears. Okay? We hope for something good in the future. We fear something bad will happen. We remember the past and remember the things that bothered us. We're afraid of them happening again. We remember the good things from the past. We hope they'll happen again. So our mind is usually quite taken, you know, very difficult to actually be in the present. And so because of that, it's difficult to identify what exactly the clarity and cognizance of the mind is. Okay, so it might seem to, you know, to be easy, but it's really not so easy. Because the mind's covered by all these different layers of thoughts and emotions and hopes and fears and feelings and needs. And, you know, and you could get stuck in any of them forever, couldn't you? You know, I feel this, I need that, which is good. I mean, we need to identify feelings and needs in some aspect of our life, but when we're trying to meditate and develop concentration, feelings and needs don't matter at all. They just simply become a distraction. Yeah. Okay, so His Holiness, here's how he describes to look at the mind. So start by looking at an object that has a muted, quite uniform color. Yeah, so not something bright like our robes, but something just, you know, a very muted color that, you know, and uniform. So, you know, no checks, no plaids, no, you know, designs, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And gaze at it, but focus at the on the mind that's perceiving it. So, you know, you may start out looking at that muted color, but what you're really observing is the mind that's perceiving that color. And have a strong determination to maintain your focus on that mind without being distracted. And when your mindfulness is strong on this, then as soon as a thought comes in your mind, or a feeling, or a need, or something comes in your mind, you'll be able to identify it very quickly and then release it and return your attention just to that kind of uniform, clear, you know, clarity. And through that, you know, gradually these obscurations cease, and you'll be able to have a very stable and lucid state of mind that is just the clear and cognizant nature of the conventional mind. So when the mind is able to remain like that, in the present, undisturbed by thoughts of the past and future, then we may feel a vacuum of some sort. This vacuum is not the emptiness of inherent existence, but it's the experience of an absence of the solidity that we're so used to feeling, you know? I mean, everything we look at, everything we experience, everything seems so solid, and even our feeling of our body, you know, you tune into the tactile consciousness and your feeling of the body, and the body is something solid. So, you know, by focusing on the clear and cognizant nature of the mind, you have this kind of vacuum that's like an absence of this kind of solidity. Yes, and so we have that sensation when we remove our mind from all the external objects and internal thoughts, and then we feel that kind of absence. As we increase the duration of that experience, and then after a while, we might have a glimpse of the clear and cognizant nature of the mind. Okay, so within the experience of the absence of sense stimuli, then gradually the clarity and awareness of the mind becomes more obvious. And that clarity and awareness is, or clarity and cognizance, is the object of meditation for developing serenity on the conventional nature of the mind. So we can see here already, just identifying the object of meditation is not easy. Okay? You know, that's why some people find the breath more helpful, because we're always breathing and, you know, it's easier to look at the breath. Okay? So at the beginning, we'll be able to identify and remain on the clear and cognizant nature of the mind only for a short while. But as we continue, you know, as we keep up, then the period that we can focus on it increases. And we begin, His Holiness says, to feel like the mind is like a mirror, or the mind is like clear and still water. So we really see that the mind, you know, yeah, it just reflects things, you know, and the mind is so still. And so objects can appear and they can disappear without disturbing that stillness of the mind in which they arise. Okay, and when you can really hold your mind on that for a long time, then you can observe when thoughts and perceptions and things arise in the mind, but you don't get hooked by them because you maintain the stillness of the just clarity and cognizance. So, you know, something attractive arises, your mind doesn't immediately go to it and start conceptualizing all about it like it does now. Okay. If your attention flags, then remember a happy or suffering experience, but without indulging in those feelings. You just use that to identify the clear and cognizant nature of the mind, because the mind is what is reflecting and knowing those feelings. So, you know, if you're losing your object to meditation, that's how to get it back. Okay, so the challenge with using the conventional nature of the mind as our object for attaining serenity is that it lacks form. And so we can easily slip into meditating on just a mere conception of the lack of materiality. So instead of really identifying the clarity and cognizance of the mind, we have a conception of the lack of materiality, and that becomes our object. So that's one disadvantage. Another disadvantage is, because it's so hard to identify this and to keep the correct object, that we could also very easily fall into blank-minded meditation on nothingness. And as we know from the story of the Samye debate, you know, that is a no-no, okay, because you just stay spaced out on nothingness and, you know, no wisdom grows at all. So we have to be careful here, because we often hear meditation instructions that just say, get rid of all your conceptions. You know, conceptual minds are useless, so get rid of all your conceptual minds. I've always wondered if that's why sometimes we have the expression, holy cow, because cows don't have much conceptual mind. Okay, but I wouldn't call a cow, you know, a role model for a spiritual practitioner. Okay, so it's not really to, you know, because this was part of the debate in Samye, is how Haoshang Mahayan said, good conceptions, bad conceptions, they're all conceptions, we need to get rid of them. It's like black clouds and white clouds, it doesn't matter, they're all clouds obscuring the sky, so get rid of all of them. Okay, and Jason Kappa is very, you know, again and again pounds in the point that it's not just getting rid of concepts, yeah, because you can fall into a state that seems very comfortable, very blissful, very peaceful. You're not thinking about anything. And maybe, you know, you could even attain serenity using that. But that will just bring rebirth in the form realm, you know. And then from there, of course, you can develop deeper states of meditation and get reborn in the formless realm as well. But all those realms are still within samsara, so you're not liberated. Yeah, so that's the kind of the danger of thinking that getting rid of all concepts is the way to go. Yeah, because you just develop some concentration, you know, you mistake it for liberation, or you get so attached to that bliss that you stop caring about liberation, and, you know, and you're still in samsara. Okay, so Jay Rinpoche, you know, emphasizes again and again that, you know, to really cut the afflictions from the root, we have to perceive the lack of inherent existence. And the lack of inherent existence is not nothingness. It's not the lack. It's because the expression is the lack of inherent existence. So right there we see it's not nothingness, because nothingness would be the lack of existence. So Jay Rinpoche is just negating, I mean the Buddha is just negating a certain kind of existence that we think exists that does not exist. And that is inherent existence. So he's not advocating going to into a state of nothingness. Okay. But having said that, you know, what's the role of conceptual mind in realizing that? Because ultimately we want to be able to perceive emptiness directly without any conceptual minds at all. You know, the ultimate realization is a non-conceptual mind. Okay? But here, non-conceptual means you're not conceiving inherent existence. It doesn't mean a mind that's apprehending nothingness. Okay. And now, to understand what emptiness is, we can't just sit there and go, emptiness, 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 and then emptiness is going to appear to us and we're going to instantly identify it and know what it is. Because we've been perceiving the absence of emptiness from beginningless time. Okay, so we're not going to... the absence of emptiness means inherent existence, okay? We've been perceiving inherent existence from the beginning of time. We have no clue what the absence of inherent existence looks like. So even if it appeared to us, we wouldn't be able to identify it. So the way we have to approach the understanding of emptiness is, you know, first having a correct assumption, a mind that kind of has kind of the right idea and about what emptiness is, and then going from there, really understanding the reasonings, you know, which is why Geshe Li has been teaching so much of that, so that we can actually prove to us why it's impossible for things to exist inherently. We have to actually prove that to ourselves, because we are so used to believing that things exist inherently that, you know, just saying they don't doesn't do anything. Yeah? It's kind of like, it's a good example, you know. If you have a child, let's say, that's experienced a lot of abuse, they become very afraid. And so even when they're in situations where they're safe, they react with fear and suspicion, because that's what they were habituated with, you know, as a child for a long time. And even if you say to that child, you know, when they're in a safe place, there's nothing to fear here, you know, they can't immediately dismiss their suspicion and fear. So they have to, you may have to take them around and look everywhere and see, oh no, there is nothing here that can harm you. Yeah, it's kind of like if your parents taught you there was the boogeyman when you were little, and you believed in the boogeyman. When you got older, if somebody's, you know, and you really as a kid had this deep belief in the boogeyman, then even when you got older, if somebody said there's no boogeyman, you don't believe them, you know? And then at first you think, well, okay, I haven't seen the boogeyman. Maybe there's no boogeyman. But still in the back of your mind, there's this fear that the boogeyman's going to come get you. So I read an article once about a police officer who went with a little boy who was afraid of the boogeyman, or the monster of some sort, and went with the little boy to look all over the entire house, in every closet, under every bed, everywhere. And then when they looked everywhere and they could see no boogeyman, then the kid relaxed. So that's the same thing we do in our analytical meditation on emptiness, is we look everywhere for inherent existence, everywhere it could possibly be. And then when we can't find it anywhere, you know, then we begin to really prove to ourselves, oh, it really doesn't exist. Okay? So it's not just, you know, emptiness, emptiness. Yeah, I know emptiness. It's not like that. Okay? So I got off on a tangent about emptiness. I wonder why. Okay? So it's not just nothingness, okay? So similarly, neither, you know, meditating on emptiness or meditating on the conventional nature of the mind, neither one of them is nothingness, okay? So if we go into nothingness or just this kind of lack of materiality, then we've actually lost the object of meditation of the, you know, the conventional nature of the mind. And so although we may think we're meditating on the mind, we aren't. So Longchen Ramjampa, who was a great Nyingma teacher, he speaks about this, and he says that people who want to do this meditation on the conventional nature of the mind should spend a lot of time purifying negative karma, accumulating merit, understanding the teachings, and then practicing under the guidance of a teacher who knows how to do the meditation properly. Okay? And so then His Holiness comments, I'm taking this from the book, by the way, if you're wondering where it's coming from, that both Mahamudra and Dzogchen both emphasize meditating on the mind itself to create, cultivate serenity. If you're doing this in a way that's common to sutra and tantra, then you're not making any differentiation in terms of the level of mind. Yeah, there's, you know, it's probably the comparatively coarse level of mind. But if you're doing this in a way unique to tantra, then you're going to be wanting to develop serenity and the subtle mind of clear light. But I think you're going to probably have to have serenity before you can even identify the fundamental innate mind of clear light. Okay? And so that's also the case if you practice the union of bliss and emptiness, which is another tantric way of meditation. Okay, emptiness can also be an object of meditation to develop serenity. Okay? So some people want to use this, and this is called seeking meditation on the basis of the view. So it means like seeking serenity on the basis of having understood what emptiness is. So you can only do this, you know, this meditation is only possible for people who have an exceptionally sharp aptitude. And so people who have realized emptiness through at least, you know, a reliable inferential, an inferential reliable cognizer. Okay, so they have an inferential realization of emptiness. Because without at least that inferential realization, again, you're not going to properly identify your object to meditation. So if you can't properly identify the object of meditation, it's going to be difficult to develop serenity on it. Okay? And so if you're one of those people and you have an inferential understanding of emptiness, then to develop serenity on that, you would temporarily forsake analysis on, you know, on the ultimate mode of existence and concentrate on a conceptual understanding of it, focusing your, you know, using that emptiness that you conceptually understand as your object of meditation. But without doing, you might have to analyze at the beginning of your session to recall that, your perception of emptiness, but then you would stop the analysis and just do stabilizing meditation. However, okay, the danger here is that if we lack a correct assertion of emptiness, then, if we lack a clear assertion of emptiness, then our focus on emptiness may weaken. We may wind up meditating on nothingness. Okay, and so for that reason, most spiritual mentors recommend seeking the view on the basis of meditation. Okay, so the first one, using emptiness as our object for serenity, is seeking meditation on the basis of the view. So based on having the correct view, then you seek serenity. But most spiritual mentors recommend seeking the view on the basis of meditation. Okay, so having some experience of serenity and then seeking the view. Or at least, you know, going deeper into the view. You can seek the view from the very beginning if you want to. But so that's the reason why many meditation masters encourage us to use the image of the Buddha as the observed object when we, if we haven't yet gained a stable inferential realization of emptiness. So that brings us to using the image of the Buddha as our meditation object. So this is, Kamala Shila speaks about that in his second and third volumes of Stages of Meditation. And it's based on two sutras. One, the sutra on the concentration that perceives the Buddha of the present face to face, and the King of Concentration Sutra, the Samadhi Raja Sutra, which some of the quotations that Geshe-la is going through come from Samadhi Raja. It's a very beautiful sutra. I mean, it's incredible. Okay, so using the image of the Buddha for our object of serenity is recommended by many meditation masters because it has many advantages, okay? So when you think about it, you know, let me tell you about some of the advantages, then you can see the difference between focusing on this and then, let's say, focusing on the breath as your object of serenity. Because the breath is something neutral, yeah, and it gives you that respite from afflictions, but if you can develop serenity on the image of the Buddha, you get some extra perks, okay? Extra benefit. So one benefit is it helps us to easily recall the Buddha's qualities, because when you develop that image of the Buddha, then, you know, there's the, you know, the Buddha's body, so of course you begin to understand the qualities of the Buddha's body, and that leads you also to think about the qualities of the Buddha's speech, qualities of the Buddha's mind, what a Buddha is altogether, you know, it leads you into really getting a good understanding of what the goal of our practice is, because you're visualizing the Buddha, and so you want to understand what the Buddha is or who the Buddha is much better. Okay, and so by easily being able to recollect the Buddha's qualities and developing serenity on that, then at the time we die, you know, what are we going to think about? We're creatures of habit. Our focus will go to the Buddha because we're very, very well habituated, you know, through developing serenity on the image of the Buddha. And if you can die thinking of the Buddha, you know, then you don't have to worry about your next rebirth, okay? Because your mind's going to be in a virtuous state. It'll be easy to take refuge in the Buddha. And if you have that virtuous state of mind at the time you die, then that makes it very easy for a seed of a virtuous karma to ripen. And then that becomes your propelling karma that will... or projecting karma that will project you into a good rebirth in the next life. Focusing on the Buddha as our object of serenity also deepens our refuge and inspires our mind, and it creates merit, which contributes to the attainment of the Buddha's form body. Remember when we studied Precious Garland? Yeah, the collection of merit is the principal cause for Buddha's form body. The collection of wisdom is the principal cause for the Dharmakaya. And then also, if we develop focus, you know, concentration on the image of the Buddha, then when we do other practices, like doing the purification with the 35 Buddhas, mandala offerings, any other kind of practice that involves visualizing the Buddha, that practice is going to come alive for us in a very special way because we're so familiar with imagining the Buddha. And I think also, you know, if we can just imagine, you know, the Buddha and really feel like we're in the presence of the Buddha, you know, and develop a habit with that, then, I mean, our mind is going to be very, very peaceful. And, you know, feelings of loneliness and suspicion and all of that stuff isn't going to be there because we feel like we're in the presence of the Buddha all the time, which would be nice to feel, wouldn't it? Yeah? To think, yeah, I'm in the presence of the Buddha and, you know, okay, all hell's breaking loose around me, but I don't need to focus on that. Yeah, because my best friend, the Buddha, is here in front of me. Yeah, so it I think it can really make the mind more stable emotionally, and then also developing that kind of concentration on the Buddha makes it easy when we then go into tantric practice, where we have to visualize ourselves as the Buddha and visualize the mandala and, you know, do all sorts of complex visualizations to develop very, very deep kind of serenity and concentration. Okay, so those are the benefits. So then how do we do that meditation? So first we do the six preliminary practices. Do you remember those? What's the first one? Clean the room. Make offerings in the shrine. Sit in the 7-point Virochana position, which, by the way, I see some people not sitting in that position, people sitting with their hands on their knees. You know, Jay Rinpoche really emphasizes, and this is also from the tantric tradition, to put your hands, the right and the left, the thumbs touching, and this is in your lap. Yeah, so try and do that. So that's the third one. Fourth, you can do some breathing meditation in there, but what's the fourth one? Take refuge. Yeah, taking refuge, generating bodhicitta. Fifth one, seven limb prayer. Sixth one, yeah, Yeah, making requests. Making requests. What's interesting is in the Lamrim Chenro, Jay Rinpoche combines the mandala offering with making the request. And he doesn't talk at all about this the long prayers to all the lineage lamas that we do now. I find that quite interesting, you know. So I wonder, you know, at his time, if they did that or if this is something that developed after Jay Tsongkhapa. Yeah, because he doesn't mention it at all in the Lamrim Chenmo. Okay, so you do the six preliminary practices that we do at the beginning of meditation sessions. And then at the beginning, when we're first learning this meditation, then it's good to have a picture or a painting or a statue of the Buddha, and we can look at it and then, you know, to familiarize our mind with it. So it's good here to choose one particular image of the Buddha, yeah, and so that you can really focus on that, because it's important when you're developing serenity not to keep changing objects. So certainly not, you know, once you have the mind that says, I'm going to develop serenity, then you're not going to change object one day on the Buddha, the next day on the breath, the next day on, you know, love, the next day on something else, you know. But you're going to keep with just one object. And then even within that, you want to make it, to make your the object that appears to you pretty much the same every day. So it's not like, you know, one day the Buddha's this big and then the next day the Buddha's this big and one day the Buddha has blue hair and the next day the Buddha has, you know, brown hair and one day he's you know, sitting, you know, in his usual position, and the next day he's sitting in another position, or he's standing up, or, you know, something like that. So you don't want to do that. When you're developing serenity, you really want to keep your mind, you know, kind of on the same object without changing things all the time. Yeah. And our mind is so imaginative, you know, it changes all these things. And people come to me and they say, I was trying to visualize the Buddha as I always do. And then all of a sudden, you know, I visualized the Buddha and he was, he's like standing up and his hands are in a different position. Or all of a sudden I got, you know, Tara came to mind so clear, you know, and it's just so clear. I couldn't get the Buddha, but Tara's so clear today. You know, from the instructions in the text, it says, you don't go with that. You know, you go back to the object that you're developing your serenity with. Yeah. So all those, and our mind is so creative. I mean, you know how it is. Yeah. These things appear to it and they're so vivid and they're so bright and they're, you know, yeah, and then the next day some other fantastic appearance, and the next day some other great thing, and you think, oh, I must be really near enlightenment, you know? I got Tara yesterday and Vajrapani today and Chenrezig, you know, the day before yesterday, and this is just fantastic. And it's like, you know, no, go back to your object of meditation and stick with that.
I've seen in prayers to Tara, it mentions that Amitabha shines from her hair knot.
Yeah.
So I've wonder if I need perfect visualization of Amitabha before I can visualize Tara.
Okay, so if you're using Tara as your object, you know, yes, Amitabha is sitting on top of her crown, but that whole thing becomes your object for developing serenity. It's not like there's two objects, one is Tara and one is the small Amitabha on her head. That it's not like that. The whole thing Okay. So when you're, so, you know, find a statue, painting, something that you really like and use that. And you may develop, you know, what the image that comes to your mind may not be exactly what that painting or statue is, but as long as it's something stable, you know, comparatively stable. It may take you a while to get it stable, you know, kind of like Buddha sits still. Actually, it's not the Buddha moving, it's our mind moving. Okay. Or another way to do it is if you've heard a very eloquent description of what the Buddha looks like, then sit down and go through the, you know, all the elements of that description and visualize according to that. Okay, you could do it either way. When you're visualizing the Buddha, think of him as three-dimensional. So you're not visualizing just a flat, you know, kind of like a Buddha sticker or something like that. And you're not visualizing a statue made out of brass, but, you know, a living being. The Buddha is a living being in the space in front of you. His body is made of golden light, so it's not dense. It's completely transparent, made of golden light. If you imagine the Buddha quite small, it will make the mind more alert. So if you need to be, you know, more alert, sometimes you do that. If you make it too small, your mind might get very tight. So you got to, you know, kind of get the right size. Visualizing it very bright will help if you're having laxity. Yeah, so if your mind's getting lax and even lethargic, then you brighten it up. You know, you turn up the brightness on it. If your mind is scattering a lot, then you might think of the Buddha as being heavy, you know, or dense light. You know, somehow that helps your mind from, you know, scattering. Okay, so at the beginning, you go over the basic general features of the Buddha, starting with his head, his torso, his arms, his legs, everything like that. So you go over the general features, and then whatever image you get, you focus your mind on that. So it doesn't need to be, you know, 100% clear, because at the beginning we're not going to get everything clear. It might just be some kind of golden shape in the shape of a human being, okay, at the beginning. But whatever image you get, then you focus your mind one-pointedly on that. Yeah, if you insist that you have to have every detail of the body correct and vivid in your mind before you stop and focus the mind, then actually that's going to take you longer to develop serenity. Yeah, so you have to, just whatever you get, you focus your mind on that. Yeah, and then if it starts to fade and it starts to get dull, then you start going over the details again, you know, and refresh your mind by going over the details. If there's a certain part of the Buddha's body that appears very vividly to you, like for me, I really like focusing on the Buddha's eyes, yeah, then you can kind of zoom in more to that part of the body that becomes very clear. Of course, you still have, you know, the rest of the whole image. It isn't like, you know, if it's the eyes that really appeal to you, then it's not like two eyes and then the rest is empty space. There's the whole Buddha there, but you're focusing more in on the Buddha's eyes. But of course, you know that the whole rest of his body is there too.
So when you say zoom, I kind of imagine, like, you know, you kind of zoom in on a computer. Are you talking about that, or just making it the most clear part?
No, I'm just making it zoom, not like, you know, you go closer or it gets bigger, but you just focus your attention on that part of the body. Okay.
Good evening, Venerable. Is it allowed for one to search for an image, a particular image that resonates with them, to help them develop concentration during meditation?
Is it helpful? I missed the last part. Search for an image that...
A particular image.
A particular
image. That they resonate with.
Yeah. You know, if you want to look at something before you do the serenity, then you might look at a few different images and choose one that really appeals to you. Okay. So, so like I said, you do the... Go through all the all the features, focus on whatever image you get. If it fades, then go over the features again, refocus your mind. And if there's a special part, you can just kind of focus more on that, but retain the whole image. So, yeah, and don't try and insist on that every detail's got to be clear at the beginning. Because if you do, you'll make your mind so tight trying to get every detail very clear. Okay. Now, people are very different. So for some people, the image of the Buddha will appear easily. For other people, it won't. Okay. For them, if I say pizza, for sure a good image comes. You know, so if you're one of these people who says, but I can't visualize. Really, actually, you know, we're visualizing all the time. And that's what makes this a very skillful way, is because it takes that natural tendency of our mind to visualize and puts it on a virtuous object. Yeah? Because like I say, if I say visualize pizza, even your eyes are open, you have a clear image of pizza, don't you? Yeah? And then if I say visualize the Buddha, then you go, I can't visualize the Buddha even with my eyes lowered. But it's simply a matter of familiarity. You know, we're more familiar with pizza. If I say think of what your home looks like, you have an image. If I say think of what your mom and dad like, even your parents died years ago, you have an image in your mind. Yeah, so we visualize all the time. So, you know, don't tell yourself you can't do it. But so for some people, the image comes easier. Some people, they have to work harder at it. But at the same time, some people will have a clear image and other people won't have a clear image. And some people will have a stable image and other people won't have such a stable image. So, you know, there's all these different factors, and so you just keep on practicing and coming back to it, and then gradually, simply by the force of habit, yeah, then the image will come easily, it will be clear, and it will be stable, yeah? And then we're going to go into, in a little bit, how to get rid of the distractions and, you know, deal with our monkey mind while we're trying to develop concentration. But we have to have an object we're developing concentration on. Yeah. So meditation is not just sitting down and closing your eyes, you know. And this is part of the thing that concerns me a lot with what's going on in the West, is, you know, when meditation gets, you know, when the name gets mentioned in Time and Newsweek, then you know it's mainstream. And then, people think that sometimes it's just sitting down and daydreaming. Yeah? You sit down, you imagine a beautiful setting, everything, you know, all your objects of attachment there. You imagine this whole thing that where all your needs and wants and everything is fulfilled and you're in the pure, you know, your own samsaric pure land, so to speak. And, you know, because sometimes, you know, people are encouraged by different counselors or therapists to visualize different things. And then people think that that's meditation. Yeah. So there's a big difference just between visualization exercises and meditation. Yeah. There's a big difference between watching your breath to calm your mind when you're listening to an app, and actually meditating with the breath as your object of concentration. So, you know, before we meditate, we really need to have some instructions. And we also need, I think, to have a very clear motivation. Yeah, are we meditating just to feel good now? You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you want to meditate to feel good now, it certainly beats feeling bad now. But, you know, I'm talking right now to people who are Buddhist practitioners. Yeah, so if you're a Buddhist practitioner, then you want to be really clear on what your motivation is for doing the meditation, you know, and then study and learn how to do the, you know, to meditate correctly, and then learn the instructions and follow them. Okay, that's all quite important. I went into my first, you know, the first session on the retreat I went to with, you know, with Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa, you know, they were late. And so Nick Rebush, he was a monk at that time, he was leading the course together with Thupten Wangmo. And he said, okay, let's meditate until the lamas come. So I had no idea what meditation was. Yeah. I mean, I was there with my hair down to here and my peasant blouse and my Indian skirt and earrings, and what am I supposed to do? So I remembered seeing one magazine and people had their hands like this on their knees. So I didn't want to look like I didn't know what I was doing, even though I didn't know what I was doing. So I sat there trying to roll my eyes back in my head. You know, all it does is give you a headache. Yeah. But, I mean, this is how we start out. We don't know anything. So thank goodness they came fairly soon. Yeah? So I was like, crazy. Okay, now questions.
So I'm trying to figure out how to keep the whole image in sight, but also keep the details, because, you know, to get a detail, you kind of have to focus on one area, mm-hmm. at least when you use your visual consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I look at the Buddha there, if I look at his shoulder, the rest kind of goes a little blurry. I mean, not literally, but, you know, my attention is not on it.
That's fine.
So I'm wondering, is it possible to see the whole object and all of it be like, super detailed.
As you get more expert in doing this, yes. At the beginning, no.
So the mental consciousness operates kind of differently than the visual consciousness in terms of seeing things. Okay, thank you. And I also have a question about the breath versus visualizations. I've heard it said that you kind of have to determine what works best for you as a individual or what's best for you at the moment. All right, you know, at that point in time. So I understand all these advantages of using the Buddha, but could it be that, you know, it's just not really, that a person could use other objects and get further?
Okay, now I've just gotten done teaching a lot of objects. Why do you think I did that?
You ended with a great sell on the Buddha.
Yeah, but why do you think I went through all those other objects?
Because there are other objects you can use.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I haven't gotten to the point yet about how to choose an object. Okay. But, yeah. I mean, depending on your aptitude and so on, that's why there's many, many objects.
In our daily practices, we have the option of viewing the entire merit field and the eternal sangha and the sky, and we also do pujas on a regular basis. Are these not switching visual objects into different forms of different Buddhas?
Okay. When, no, it's not switching objects. Because when we do a puja, for example, and we're visualizing the merit field or whatever, the more we've trained our mind in serenity, even if it's on another object, the clearer that visualization will be. But when we're doing a puja, we don't do serenity meditation. We have the image, you know, let's say of the merit field appearing to us, but then what we're doing is, you know, following the sequence, the meditation sequence in the puja. Yeah, because developing serenity, when you're doing that, you're not chanting, you're not making offerings, you're not thinking about other things, you're just totally on that one object. Yeah, but of course, you may develop serenity on one object, but you do other practices during the day too.
So,
if you're going to do a serenity retreat, then you're going to go more quickly through your other practices. But, usually we have a variety of practices that we do.
So it's okay to switch objects as long as you aren't specifically aiming to cultivate serenity at those moments?
Right. Yeah. Because serenity is a particular type of meditation, you know, where you're just focusing on that object and on nothing else. Yeah. When you're doing Lamrim meditation, you're contemplating a theme, a subject, you know, a whole topic, and you're thinking about how your life relates to that and so on. That's a different kind of meditation. The more concentration you develop in your serenity, the easier it's going to be to stay focused when you do your analytical Lamrim meditation. But there are different kinds of meditations. Yeah.
And is the sequence of visualization before the Lamrim analytical meditation, is that sort of a glance meditation developing visualization stability?
So if we're doing this like as part of our daily practice, not as a retreat thing, but part of our daily practice, and we want to just develop some more habituation with concentration, yeah, then you would do the, you would start out with the preliminary practices. And then when it got to the point of visualizing the merit field, if let's say you're, you know, like you've been doing the meditation on the Buddha, yeah, then you would visualize the Buddha and you would stop there maybe for 5 or 10 minutes or 15 minutes and try and develop serenity on the Buddha and then continue on and do the rest of your practice and do some Lamrim later and then dedicate the merit at the end.
I wanted to understand that when you were talking about seeking serenity on the basis of the view, the person had developed an inference and then stabilize their mind on that, but the drawback was that they might not have had the inference very strong.
No, they may not have a real clear understanding of it, and so it could easily fade. Yeah. You can have a correct understanding without, in terms of the clarity of the mind being real clear. Okay. Now, usually when you do serenity meditation in a retreat style, then they recommend, you know, you have different sessions during the day. But within a session, yeah, you meditate, let's say, for 5 minutes. Then you open your eyes and look around. Then you meditate for another 5 minutes, open your eyes. And so you do like that in a whole session. You wouldn't get up and walk around between your five-minute things. But they say that it's much more effective just to try and focus the mind for 5 minutes you know, and then take a slight break, look around, you know, for, I don't know, 30 seconds, a minute or something like that. Not like this, but, you know, just open your eyes. And then do another 5 minutes. And then gradually as you're, and the reason for doing that is then your mind doesn't get so tired. If you, you know, go in and you say, okay, I'm going to do an hour and a half session to develop serenity on the Buddha, and I'm just going to focus on the Buddha. You know, I mean, our mind is so bazonky, and it's going to go all over the place, and you're going to be trying to grab it back. You know, it's going back to when you're 5 years old and going to the future, and then your boyfriend here, and your that you're saying, you know, your second grade teacher, and then your sixth grade teacher, and then what somebody said to you 15 years ago. And you're combating all these distractions for an hour and a half. After you get up, you're not going to want to go back to your meditation seat. Okay? So that's why they say do short sessions so that when you get up from your seat, you feel like, oh, that was pleasant, you know? I want to go back and sit again. Yeah. So this whole thing of, you know, our Western way of, you know, I'm going to push. I'm going to get that concentration. Yeah, I'm going to sit here for an hour for sure. Yeah, that attitude of mind is not very conducive for developing concentration. It's conducive for developing what they call lung. Okay? Lung is an imbalance of your internal energies, you know, an imbalance of your qi. When you push, yeah, when you have high expectations, when you're, you know, this, I'm going to pull myself up by my bootstrap mentality for meditation, you know, and you just make your mind tight and stressed. You're hindering yourself, not helping yourself. Okay. So that's why short sessions, hey, do some more. And then gradually, as you can focus more, then you can extend the length. Spell what? Lung. Sometimes it's spelled L-O-O-N-G and sometimes L-U-N-G. Okay. But don't get it. It's much better to prevent lung than it is to get lung and then have to do something about it, okay? Yeah. So that's why they say, you know, in your break time between meditation sessions, look long distances, yeah, relax the mind, look at nature, you know, something like that, so that you just find a way to have more expanse. I mean, that's why when we were looking for land for the Abbey, I was very clear it's got to be a place with a sense of expanse and where you can see the sky, you know, the night sky and everything, because all of that is very, very helpful for meditation. You know, going to choose your meditation place in a valley, yeah, where you don't have much of a view, or where it's very cloudy all the time, that just makes it a little bit harder.
And I understand your worries about meditation practice in the West these days. Mm-hmm. For example, one of them is mindfulness also. I don't know if you have anything to, I mean, so what I think they're doing is watching the mind and watching the thoughts arise and
yeah,
these kind of things. And I think for some people it helps.
Yeah.
But I don't really know, like, do you have an opinion about this? Or?
Oh, yeah, I have lots of opinions about this. Yes, I have lots of opinions. Actually, you know, at some of our meditation gatherings, our monastic gatherings, we've discussed this. Bhikkhu Bodhi actually wrote a paper about it. That's very nice. But yeah, the whole mindfulness movement, I think what would be really helpful is to clarify Buddhist meditation, one aspect of which is mindfulness meditation. And also, we talk about mindfulness as a mental factor that you use in all types of meditation, even if it's not the four establishments of mindfulness. It's a mental fact that we use. That to discern that from secular mindfulness, you know? And I think discerning the two would be very helpful not only for the Buddhist practitioners, but also for the secular people, yeah? Because they're very, very different. And with the secular mindfulness, if you say it's a Buddhist practice, then there's people who don't want to become Buddhists who won't learn how to do it. And it could be a kind of mental exercise that's very helpful for them. Yeah, so I think it's better that they can say it's derived from Buddhism, but it's just secular mindfulness. Okay, and then the people who teach it, they don't consider themselves Buddhist teachers. Yeah, they're not meditation teachers. They're, you know, like Jon Kabat-Zinn, he's doing marvelous work and with people with chronic pain, you know, and teaching a kind of mindfulness. And, you know, that's very good. But he doesn't go around saying, I'm a meditation teacher or I'm a Buddhist teacher or something like that. So, you know, really differentiating them. Also because the motivation for doing the practices are very different. If you're a Buddhist, you're doing it, you have refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha. You have either a motivation for a good rebirth, for liberation, for full awakening. If you're doing secular mindfulness, you know, you just want to relax and feel better. That's basically, you know, you're not looking for a religious worldview or a religious practice. You're looking for something that's going to help you calm your mind, you know, and clear it because your life is stressful. So I think it's good, really differentiate what you're doing and why you're doing it and, you know, where it's coming from. I think secular mindfulness can be very helpful for some people, but that's why I say don't mix it up with Buddhist meditation. Yeah, and think that they're the same thing. They're very, very different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In regards to the question you just answered, Venerable, can a Buddhist, for example, participate in certain retreats if their motivation is Buddhist, even if the other people's are not? Or is a Buddhist who has taken refuge in five precepts, should they only partake in specifically Buddhist retreats only?
I would have to know what the other kind of retreats they're doing are. Like what?
Yes, for example, what would your view be of the Goenka silent retreats?
Oh yeah, that I think that's fine. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, because Goenka practice is, you know, pretty much based on Buddhism. Yeah.
Thank you.
And you can the one thing with Goenka is he says when you do his retreats, he doesn't want you to do any other practice. So for people, at least in the Tibetan tradition, many of us have commitments to do other practices. Yeah. So the people I know who go to Goenka practice, they usually do their other practices. They just don't tell anybody. You know, because you've made a promise to your teacher, so you don't go back on that. Yeah, I talked to one Tibetan monk because apparently, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, Goenka, you know, somebody from Goenka came to Dharamsala and led a retreat. And this this monk told me, you know, that he was doing that and he had his mala and he was saying, you know, during the silent meditation, he was saying mantra, you know. So, yeah.
They do have you take the five precepts and hold them while you're at that, at Goenka's style meditations.
Do they do a ceremony where you take
no,
the five?
No, you just agree that you will live by those while you're there.
Yeah, so that makes sense. That's good to do. I have friends who are Chinese nuns who teach Goenka meditation, you know, and they do their Chinese practice too.
Someone online has asked, is our chosen object of meditation something that's going to stay with us for the rest of our life?
So,
is the object that we choose for meditation, is that going to be something that we stay with for the rest of our life? Or is there a point where we're going to need to change it?
Usually, if I don't know that you could may say the rest of your life, you know, it could be that, you know, at some point, you know, you start doing tantric practice and your teacher recommends that you use the deity there that you're meditating on, you know. Or your teacher may say, no, just develop serenity using the figure of the Buddha and don't switch, yeah.
I'm wondering about the posture because you specifically mentioned hand position.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the main reason I break from that hand position is from an old hand injury.
Ah, okay. If you have a hand injury, you know, that, and it makes it difficult for you to hold your hands like that, then, yeah, you have to do something different. But if you, you know, can get it to the point where it's not causing you pain and it's not inflaming the injury, you know, then do that. Yeah, it's the same thing, you know, like they say sit in Vajra position, but many people can't do that. They have injuries, they have limited, you know, flexibility with their legs, so you do what is possible. Yeah, but whenever possible, we try and follow the instructions as they're given. And then when we can't, then we have to modify. Okay, that's it. So we'll dedicate and then continue next week.